Lola smiled back.
Touché.
I've never even opened a bank statement, Mr. Bricola. John Merrill's a financial wizard. If I could do it, couldn't he?
Davy Bucola thought, I underestimated her. She's not a Fruit Loop. Misguided, maybe, but she's nobody's fool. All right, Mrs. Brookstein, I'll do some digging for you, but I'm warning you now, don't believe in foregone conclusions. They're against my religion.
I understand.
If I take this case, I'll take it with an open mind. I'm digging for the truth. You might not like what I find.
I'll take my chances.
Another thing you should know. Nothing's going to happen quickly. This is a complicated case. A lot of the information is classified. I have FBI sources, guys in the police, and the SEC who'll talk to me, but it's slow work. Grace looked at the four walls around her.
Time's about the one thing I have left, Mr. Bricola. I'm not going anywhere.
Davy Bucola shook her hand. In that case, Mrs. Brookstein, I'm your man.
Where are you going, honey? Come back to bed.
Harry Bane looked at his wife's voluptuous naked body sprawled out across the sheets. Then he looked at his watch. 6 a.m. Fucking quorum.
I can't. We've got a team meeting at 7.
Can't you say you're sick?
Not really. I called the meeting. The whole of America hated Lenny Brookstein, but at that moment, no one hated him quite as much as Harry Bane.
I can outsmart a street fighter like Brookstein, Bane had reasoned when he first took the case. It's not like we're looking for a pair of cufflinks.
$75 billion is missing. That's like trying to hide a country.
Excuse me, but, has anyone seen Guatemala?
Some dead Jewish guy from Queens mislaid it last June.
Of course he would find the money. How could he not? Yet here he was, a year later, with nothing.
Harry Bane, Gavin Williams, and their team had commandeered Quorum's old offices as a base for their investigation. With John Merrill's help, the task force had spent millions chasing leads all over the world, from New York to Grand Cayman to Paris to Singapore. Between them, Harry Bane, Gavin Williams, and John Merrill had clocked more air miles than a migrating flock of Canadian geese, produced enough paper to wipe out an entire rainforest, conducted thousands of interviews, and seized countless bank records. If Lenny Brookstein took a shit between January 2001 and June 2009, the FBI had a record of it. But still no goddamn money. Their failure wasn't from lack of effort. Gavin Williams might be a card-carrying weirdo, but you couldn't fault the guy for commitment. As far as Harry Bane could tell, Williams had no friends or family, no personal life at all. He lived and breathed Quorum, following the impenetrable, circuitous paper trails of trades Lenny Brookstein had left behind him with a dogged bloodlust of a foxhound. Then there was John Merrill, the Quorum insider-turned-police asset. John was an odd bird, too. So shy, he was almost autistic. The guy still teared up whenever Lenny Brookstein's name was mentioned. In the beginning, Harry had wondered whether John might be implicated in the fraud himself. But the more he learned about Lenny Brookstein's business practices, the less he suspected John Merrill, or Andrew Preston, or any of the other employees. Brookstein was so secretive he made the CIA look indiscreet. Surrounded by people, a social animal to the last, at the end of the day, Lenny had trusted no one. No one except his wife. Rumors on the team were that John Merrill was unhappy at home.
Harry Bain had met Caroline Marrable once and could well believe it. That bitch probably wore stilettos and a whip to bed. Or a Gestapo uniform. No wonder John was happy to put in long hours on the task force. So would I be if I was married to Madame Whiplash.
Okay, folks, what have we got?
The elite group of FBI agents who formed the Quorum Task Force stared at their boss dejectedly. One joker piped up.
Gavin's thinking of heading out to Bedford Hills again, right, Gav? He's gonna use his legendary charm with the ladies to get Miss B to sing like a bird.
The rest of the group sniggered. Gavin Williams' obsession with breaking Grace Brookstein had become a running joke. Either Grace didn't know where Lenny had stashed the cash, or she knew, but she wasn't telling. Either way, Williams was beating a dead horse and everyone could see it but him. Gavin didn't join in the laughter.
I have no plans to return to Bedford, Stephen. Your information is incorrect.
The joker murmured to his partner.
Your information is incorrect.
Is he human? He sounds like R2-fucking-D2.
No kidding,
his partner replied more loudly.
Help me, Obi-Wan Brookstein! You're my only hope!
More laughter.
Gavin Williams glanced around the table at his so-called colleagues. If he could, he would have ripped every one of their hearts out with his bare hands and stuffed them down Harry Bane's smug, self-satisfied throat till he choked. What did any of them have to laugh about? They were all part of the biggest, lamest operation in FBI history. If he, Gavin, were running the show, things would be different.
Harry Bane said, Okay then, so it's all on this trip to Geneva.
John Merivale had spent the last 3 weeks researching a huge swap trade from 2006. The trail led as far as numbered account in Switzerland, then went cold.
Gavin, I'd like you and John to make the trip together this time. Two heads may prove better than one.
John Merivale failed to hide his surprise. He and Gavin Williams usually worked independently, following up on separate leads. This was the first time Bane had asked them to travel together.
I'm fine to handle the trip to Geneva alone, Harry.
I know you are, but I'd like the two of you together on this one. John Merivale's relationship with Harry Bane had come a long way since Harry's bad cop interview with him before Grace's trial. It had taken months to persuade not just Bane, but the entire task force that he was on their side, that he was as much a victim of Lenny Brookstein as anyone else. But slowly, with the steady, quiet patience on which he'd built his entire career, John Merivale had won them over. He was no longer frightened of Harry Bane, but at the same time, he didn't want to cross him. John still loathed confrontation. As much as Gavin Williams' dour, monosyllabic presence was bound to ruin the Switzerland trip, John didn't want to fight about it.
Harry Bane said, We need to build some more team spirit. Bounce ideas off each other more. Somehow we've got to break this deadlock.
John Merivale tried to imagine a scenario in which anyone might bounce an idea off Gavin Williams.
Bane must really be getting desperate.
The flight from New York was bumpy and unpleasant. John Merivale felt his stomach flip over with nerves. He tried to make small talk with his companion.
Of course, legally, we can't force the Swiss to cooperate with us, but I know the guys at the Banque de Genève pretty well. I may be able to persuade them to stretch a point.
Silence. It was like talking to a corpse. Gavin Williams closed his eyes.
Persuade them? Stretch a point? They're criminals who laundered Brookstein's dirty money. They should be stretched on a rack till their limbs are wrenched out of their sockets, and then screams can be heard from the Statue of Liberty.
Have you spent much time in Geneva, Gavin?
No.
It's a beautiful city. The mountains, the lake. Lenny and I used to love coming here.
Gavin Williams pulled on his sleep mask. Good night. The plane rattled on. John Merivale was booked into Le Amour, an exclusive 5-star hotel in Geneva's old town. In the old days, he and Lenny had enjoyed many fine meals in Le Amour's famous restaurant, which had been built in the 13th century and decorated with exquisite frescoes, painted facades, and art treasures. Lenny used to say it was like eating in the Sistine Chapel. Gavin Williams refused to join him, preferring the more modest Hotel Eden. It was right on the lake, but Gavin purposely chose a room with no view that was closer to the gym and business center. "We're not here to enjoy ourselves," he told John tersely.
"Heaven forbid."
John thought again how much Lenny would have despised Gavin Williams, his joylessness, his anger. Wandering alone around Geneva's chilly medieval streets after dinner, he thought how much more fun the trip would have been had Lenny been with him.
"What do you mean I'm not coming?"
Gavin Williams looked fit to be tied. He and John were breakfasting together at Gavin's hotel, prior to the meeting with the people from the Banque de Genève.
"I have a relationship with the bankers. They're more likely to trust me if I go alone."
"Trust you?"
Gavin Williams balled up his napkin in his fist.
"Yes, banking, especially in Switzerland, is all about trust.
Gavin Williams thought furiously. "You were the right-hand man to the biggest thief of all time, and you have the nerve to pontificate about trust? Even now, even after Quorum's disgrace, it's still an old boys' club, isn't it? You're still one of them, a banker, and I'm not." Out loud, he snapped, "Don't promise me, John. I've written textbooks on Swiss banking."
"Marvelous. Then you know what I'm talking about.
These people you claim to have a relationship with are money launderers. They are scum, and their trust is worth nothing. I will attend the meeting whether they like it or not."
John Merivale could not resist a fleeting, triumphant smile.
"I'm afraid you won't, Gavin. You see, I already cleared it with Harry Bain. I'm going alone. You're to follow up on any information I get out of them. Take it up with Harry if you're not happy."
"How can I take it up with Harry?" Gavin spluttered. "It's 3 in the morning in New York."
"Is it?"
John smiled again.
"What a pity."
3 days later, they flew back to the States. John Merivale reported to Harry Bain. Whatever money Lenny had stashed in Geneva was long gone. Some of it was paid out to investors in returns. The rest was siphoned into property deals in South America. Gavin Williams would fly to Bogota tomorrow to see what he could uncover. Harry Bain put his head in his hands. Bogota. And so it goes on.
"I'm sorry about Geneva, sir. I really thought that it might be a breakthrough."
Harry Bain hated the way John Merivale insisted on calling him sir. Nobody else did. He told Merivale to cut it out months ago, but it was like a verbal tic with the guy. Subservience was second nature to him. Not for the first time, Harry wondered what an earth had attracted a type A man's man like Lenny Brookstein to this weak, mealy-mouthed number cruncher. It didn't make any sense.
"It's okay, John. You did your best. The Bureau appreciates your efforts.
Thank you, sir. I'll keep trying.
Yeah, we're all trying, but there are no prizes for effort, not in this life.
John, do you mind if I ask you a personal question?
John looked momentarily taken aback.
Does it ever get to you?
Does what ever get to me?
You must have lost millions because of Lenny Brookstein, right? Tens of millions.
John Merrivale nodded. You see your entire life work destroyed, your good name dragged through the mud. Doesn't it, I don't know, test your faith in humanity?
John Merrivale smiled.
I'm afraid I never had much faith in humanity.
Okay, then. In friendship. In a flash, the smile was gone.
Let me tell you something about friendship, Mr. Bane. Friendship is everything, everything. It's the only thing that really matters in this world. People can say what they like about me, but I'll tell you this. I'm a loyal friend.
He turned and walked away. Harry Bane watched him go. He felt uneasy, but he had no idea why. In a hotel bathroom in Bogota, Gavin Williams stood under a cold shower, scrubbing his body with soap. It was so hard to stay clean in this filthy world. Colombia was the greatest cesspool of all. Every aspect of life here was diseased, tainted by greed, infected by corruption. It made Gavin sick. As he scrubbed away, cleansing his soiled body, Gavin's thoughts turned to John Merrivale. John had humiliated him in Switzerland. No doubt he thought he had had the last laugh. But Gavin Williams knew better. John Merrivale had patronized the wrong man. He would live to regret it.
Chapter 12. Grace's first year at Bedford Hills passed quickly. Most long-term prisoners look back on the first 12 months of their sentence as the worst. Karen described it to Grace as like cold turkey, except you're not withdrawing from drugs, you're withdrawing from freedom. It was a good analogy, but Grace didn't feel that way. For Grace, the first year of prison was like awakening from a lifelong slumber. For the first time, she was seeing life as it really was. She was surrounded by women from ordinary backgrounds, poor backgrounds. Women who had grown up less than 20 miles away from where Grace grew up, but who lived in a world as foreign and as alien to her as the rice paddies of China or the deserts of Arabia. It was wonderful. In her old life, Grace now realized friendships had been a mirage. Fragile, hollow alliances based solely on money or status. At Bedford Hills, she observed a different kind of female friendship, one born of adversity and strengthened through suffering. If someone said a kind word to you here, they meant it. Slowly, cautiously, Grace began to forge bonds with Karen, with some of the girls she worked with in her new job at the Children's Center, even with Cora Buds. Cora was a mass of contradictions. Violent, moody, and uneducated, she could certainly be a bully, as Grace had learned to her cost on her second night at Bedford. But Cora Buds was also a loyal friend and devoted mother. After Grace's suicide attempt, Cora's maternal side took over. It was Cora, more even than Karen Willis, who had led the campaign to change their fellow prisoners' minds about Grace Brookstein. When a group of women at the Children's Center froze Grace out, refusing to talk to her or even eat in the same room, it was Cora who confronted them.
"Give the bitch a chance! She didn't steal nothing! You kidding me? She wouldn't know how!"
"She's rich, Cora."
She ain't even a mom. How'd she get a job in here? The warden's showing her favors.
Cora Budd said,
Let me tell you something. The warden wanted her dead. That's why she sent her to me. But I'm telling yous, Grace is okay. She ain't the way they made her out to be in court and on TV. Just give her a chance.
Slowly, grudgingly, the woman began to include Grace in their conversations. Winning their acceptance and later their affection meant more to Grace than she could express. Society had labeled the women of Bedford Hills as criminals, as outcasts. Now, for the first time, Grace wondered if perhaps it was society that was criminal for casting them out in the first place. Grace had lived the American dream all her life. The fantasy of wealth, freedom, and the pursuit of happiness had been her reality since the day she was born. Here, at Bedford Hills, she witnessed the flip side of that golden coin. The hopelessness of poverty, the unbreakable cycle of fractured families, poor education, drugs, and crime, the iron grip of gang culture. It's all just a lottery. Prison was these women's destiny, the same way wealth and luxury was mine. Until someone stole it from me. Grace was luckier than most inmates. She had something rare and priceless, something that other girls at Bedford would have given their eye teeth for. A sense of purpose. Here, in jail, Grace finally had something to do, other than shop for designer clothes or plan her next dinner party. She had to find out what really happened at Quorum. It wasn't about freedom. It was about justice. About truth. If Grace had to pick one word to describe how her first year in prison made her feel, it would have been liberating. That, perhaps, was the greatest irony of all. From 9 till 3 every day, Grace worked at the Children's Center. Their work was rewarding and fun. Kids came in daily to spend their time with their mothers, and though the bond between parent and child was usually obvious, both sides sometimes struggled to fill the hours in such an artificial environment. Grace's job was to make that easier by providing some structure. Story time, reading lessons, art classes, anything that moms and kids could enjoy together without having to think too hard about where they were and why. The Children's Center was the only place at Bedford Hills where inmates were allowed to dress in outside clothing, provided for them by the Sisters of Mercy. Sister Teresa, who ran the facility, made a strong case to Warden McIntosh. The children are frightened by the uniforms. It's tough enough rebuilding maternal relationships without making Mommy look like a stranger. Grace loved the feel of ordinary cotton against her skin. She loved the cheerful routine of the work, planning activities, laying tables with jars of paint, brushes, and paper, playing games with the kids that she remembered from her own childhood. Most of all, she loved the kids themselves. When Lenny was alive, she'd never felt the desire to have children. But now that he was gone, it was as if a switch had flipped inside her. All her natural, maternal feelings came flooding out. Working at the center, Grace was aware of a feeling of inner peace, a sort of low hum of contentment that followed her everywhere. It was the only place she could shut out thoughts of Lenny and John Merrivale and how she had betrayed them. In her simple cotton blouse and long wool skirt, it was hard to distinguish Grace from the nuns who ran the center. It occurred to her that prison life was not so unlike the world of the convent. Enclosed, ordered, the days made up of a repeated series of simple, satisfying tasks. At the Children's Center, Grace felt The same deep peace of a nun fulfilling her vocation, except that she had not found God. Hers was a mission of a different kind. The only downside to Grace's work at the center came in the form of Lisa Halliday. Another A-wing lifer, Lisa had been sent to Bedford Hills after an armed robbery that left a store clerk permanently paralyzed. An aggressive bold dyke with a close-shaven blonde hair and a livid scar across her chin, Lisa Halliday was viewed as a leader by the prison's white inmates, a small but vocal minority. Inmate leaders played an important role in the running of any prison, something Warden McIntosh understood only too well. He had given Lisa Halliday a cushy work detail, and the job at the Children's Center had appeased her for a while. Until Grace Brookstein showed up. Lisa Halliday made no secret of her loathing for Grace, whom she considered to be Cora Buds's pet, and a traitor to the white girls at Bedford, not to mention a stuck-up bitch who'd somehow gotten the warden wrapped around her little finger. Lisa never missed an opportunity to bully Grace or to try to get her in trouble. The real work of Grace's days began after 3, when she was allowed 2 hours in the prison library. Davy Bucola had promised to help her. But Grace had heard nothing from Davy in months. Impatient to make some progress, she devoted all her free time to researching Quorum. There was a lot to learn. Following Davy's advice, she had started at the beginning. She read about the stock market, what it was and how it worked. She discovered, for the first time, what a hedge fund actually did. It had never occurred to her to ask Lenny. She researched endless articles on the economy. In the past, terms like credit crunch and bailout had washed over her. Grace had no idea what they actually meant. Now, she made it her business to know. She wanted to understand why companies like Lehman Brothers had failed. Why so many people had lost their jobs and their homes because of Quorum. The first few months were like painting the background to a huge canvas. Only once she'd finished the sky and the stormy sea could Grace begin work on the ship itself. The fraud that had brought her here. That, of course, was the most intricate, difficult part of the picture. The main problem with hedge funds, Grace learned, was that they operated behind a veil of secrecy. Top managers like Lenny never gave away their investment strategies, let alone specific details about individual trades. And that was perfectly legal. Karen Willis asked Grace, "So how did people know what they were buying into, if it was all such a big secret?"
"They didn't," said Grace. "They looked at past performance and took a bet on future performance."
"Like betting on a horse, you mean?"
"I suppose so, yeah."
"Kind of a big risk, don't you think?"
"That depends on how much you trust the manager."
People had trusted Lenny. They had trusted Quorum. But something had gone terribly wrong. The more she studied the press reports, the more Grace understood why the FBI had failed so singularly in their attempts to trace the missing money. With so much secrecy and funds passing between countless different accounts, onshore, offshore, all over the planet, it was like combing a beach for a specific grain of sand. Shares were sold before they had been bought, creating phantom profits that were then leveraged, multiplied 3, 4, 10 times before being reinvested in derivative structures so complicated that they made Grace's eyes water. Davy Bucola finally came to visit her. From the look on his face, Grace could tell he had news. She could barely contain her excitement.
"It was John Merivale, wasn't it? He stole the money. I knew it."
I don't know who stole the money.
Grace's face fell.
Oh.
My investigation took a different turn.
Davy's expression looked sober, his lips pressed together in a grim line. Grace's stomach began to churn.
What do you mean? What sort of turn?
Davy thought. When I walked in here, she looked so happy. I'm about to blow her world apart, and what if I'm wrong? Then, he thought, I'm not wrong. He leaned across the table and took Grace's hand. Mrs. Brookstein.
Grace.
Grace. I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but I believe your husband was murdered.
I'm sorry?
The room began to spin. Grace clutched the table for support.
Lenny didn't kill himself.
I know that. It was an accident. The storm...
Her words trailed off into silence. It wasn't an accident. I spent months looking into Merrivale's activities at Quorum, said Davy. But I found I was chasing my tail, so I decided to look at your husband instead. I went back over his disappearance, the investigation, what happened on Nantucket the day of the storm. Finally, I looked at the autopsy. Grace swallowed.
Go on.
It was a shambles, a joke. Death by drowning was assumed because the cadaver was washed up and because there was water in the lungs. When all this Quorum shit came to light, they ruled suicide because they figured there was a motive. But water in the lungs doesn't necessarily mean the person drowned.
It doesn't?
That body had been in the water for over a month. Of course the lungs were saturated. The question you need to ask yourself in a death like this is, how did the person get into the water in the first place? And was he alive or dead when he got there?
So you think...
I think your husband was dead before he hit the water. There was no blood in his lungs. Drowning at sea in a heavy storm like that... The pressure of so much water entering the lungs so suddenly would almost certainly cause a hemorrhage.
Almost certainly?
It wasn't just the lungs. There were other signs. The bruises to the torso. Scratches on the fingers and upper arms that could have been indicative of a struggle. And the way the head was severed. I saw the pictures. Just look at the vertebra. That wasn't fish. Not unless fish had a guillotine. Or a meat cleaver.
Grace put her hand over her mouth and retched.
Oh, shit, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be so graphic. Are you okay?
Grace shook her head. She would never be okay again. She took a deep breath, struggling to control her emotions.
Why didn't any of this come out at the inquest?
Some of it did. The bruising was mentioned but dismissed. No one wanted to see the truth, not at that time. You have to remember, your husband was the most hated man in America. Maybe it was just easier to think of him as a suicide, a coward, rather than a victim.
Easier?
Grace's head was spinning. It was all too much to take in. Davy said,
I wanted to tell you first. I know it's a hell of a shock, but this is actually good news. I think we have enough here to ask to have the inquest reopened, Grace. It would be the first step toward launching a murder investigation.
Grace was silent for a long time. At last she said,
No, I don't want the police to be involved.
But, Grace?
No.
Someone had killed Lenny, butchered him like an animal and tossed him into the waves.
What use were the police, or the courts, or the whole corrupt, disgusting so-called justice system?
What justice was there for Lenny or for me? America damned us both for no better reason than it was easier. They let Lenny's killer walk away and left me here to rot. Well, damn America. The time for justice is past.
Davy was confused. What do you want me to do?
I want you to find out who did it. If it was John Merrivale or someone else, I want to know who killed my husband. I want to know how he did it and why. I want to know everything, and I want to be sure. I'm not interested in reasonable doubt.
Davy said, okay, and then?
And then we'll think about next steps. And then I'm going to kill them.
After lights out, Grace lay awake, her mind racing. Whoever murdered Lenny had to have been on Nantucket the day of the storm. It could have been a stranger, but she knew that was unlikely.
It was someone close to us. It had to be someone close to Quorum, to the missing money.
She thought back to the vacation, to their house guests. Connie and Michael, Honor and Jack, Maria and Andrew, Caroline and John, the Quorum family. Except they weren't family, they weren't friends. All of them had abandoned Grace in an hour of need. One of them had killed Lenny. Grace no longer wanted justice. She wanted vengeance. She would have vengeance. That night, Grace Brookstein began planning her escape. Chapter 13.
Karen Willis rubbed her eyes. It was 2 in the morning and Grace Brookstein was climbing into her bed.
Grace? What is it? Are you sick? Grace shook her head. Beneath the blanket, the two of them huddled together for warmth. Karen felt the softness of Grace's breasts against her back, the smell of her skin, the soft caress of her breath. Instinctively, she slid a hand under Grace's nightdress, reaching for the silky wetness between her thighs.
I love you.
Karen pressed her lips to Grace's. For a few glorious seconds, Grace responded, kissing her back. Then she pulled away.
I'm sorry. I can't.
Grace felt torn. Part of her was tempted to accept the comfort Karen was offering. After all, Lenny was gone. And Grace loved Karen too, in a way. But she knew it wasn't right. She didn't love Karen in that way. Not really. Even if she had, it would have been wrong to raise her hopes, especially considering what she was about to tell her. Karen looked anguished. How could she have been so stupid? She misread the signals.
Oh, God! Are you angry with me?
No, not at all. Why would I be?
I would have never made a move if I hadn't thought... I mean, you came into my bed.
I know. I'm sorry.
Look, it was my fault, said Grace. I needed to talk to you.
I need your advice.
My advice?
Uh-huh. I'm going to escape.
It was the break in the tension Karen needed. She laughed so hard she almost woke Cora. Grace didn't get it.
What's so funny?
Oh, Grace, you can't be serious.
I'm deadly serious.
Honey, it's impossible. No one's ever escaped from Bedford Hills.
Grace shrugged.
There's a first time for everything, right?
Not for this. Karen wasn't laughing anymore.
You actually mean it, don't you?
You're out of your mind, Grace. Have you looked outside lately? There are 9 barbed-wire fences between us and freedom, all of them electrified. There are guards and dogs and cameras and guns.
I know all that.
Then you're not thinking clearly. Look, even if you found some way to escape, which you won't because it's impossible, you have one of the most recognizable faces in America. How far do you think you'll get?
Grace ran a hand over her broken nose.
I'm not so recognizable anymore. I don't look the way I used to. Anyway, I can disguise myself.
When they catch you, they'll shoot you, no questions asked.
I know that, too. It's a risk I'm prepared to take.
Karen stroked Grace's cheek in the darkness. This was madness. No one escaped from Bedford Hills. If Grace tried it, she'd be killed for sure. Even if, by some miracle, she were captured alive, it still meant Karen would never see her again. Grace would be transferred to solitary, sent out of the state, locked up in some secret CIA holding pen, never to be heard of again.
Don't do this, Grace, please. I don't want to lose you.
Grace saw Karen's eyes well up. Leaning forward, she kissed her full on the mouth. It was a passionate, lingering kiss, a kiss to be remembered by. A kiss goodbye.
I have to do it, Karen.
No, you don't. Why?
Because Lenny was murdered, okay?
Karen sat up.
What? Says who?
Davy Bucola. He found evidence, stuff that was suppressed at the inquest.
So, Bucola put her up to this. I'll kill him.
I have to find out who killed my husband.
But, Grace, I'm going to find him, and then I'm going to kill him.
Grace waited for the outrage, the shock, but it never came. Instead, Karen put her arms around her and hugged her tightly. Karen remembered Billy, her sister's boyfriend, how right it had felt when that bullet hit him between the eyes. Despite everything that had happened since, she had never regretted what she'd done. She did not want to lose Grace, but she understood.
I assume you have a plan?
Actually, that's what I wanted to talk to you about.
Sister Agnes watched Grace Brookstein clearing away a jigsaw puzzle and offered up a silent prayer to the Lord.
Thank you for bringing me this lost soul, Jesus. Thank you for allowing me to be the vessel of your redeeming grace.
Sister Agnes had only been Sister Agnes for 5 years. Before that, she was Tracy Granger, a lonely, unpopular teenage girl from Frenchtown, New Jersey. Tracy Granger had fallen in love with a local boy named Gordon Hicks. Gordon had told her he loved her, and Tracy had believed him. When Gordon got her pregnant, then promptly abandoned her, Tracy went home and swallowed as many pills as she could find. The baby did not survive. Neither did Tracy Granger. The girl who woke up from that overdose in a grimly sterile hospital bed, clutching her stomach and weeping with guilt, was not the same girl whom Gordon Hicks had so peremptorily dumped. She was not the same straight-C student who had disappointed her parents since the day she was born. She was not the same socially awkward, unlovable 10th grader whom no one invited to prom. This girl was an entirely new person, a person loved by God, a person of value, a person whose sins had been forgiven, who would one day become one with Jesus at the right hand of the Father. If anyone believed in the power of redemption, it was Sister Agnes. God had redeemed her. He had saved her life. Now, in his infinite love and mercy, he had redeemed Grace Brookstein too. And he had allowed her, Sister Agnes, to play a small part in the miracle. Only this morning, Grace told her,
"I feel so fulfilled here, Sister, working with these children, with you. It's like I've been given a second chance at life."
What a warm glow of satisfaction those words had given her. Sister Agnes hoped she was not guilty of the mortal sin of pride. She must remember that it was God who had transformed Grace, not her. And yet, Sister Agnes couldn't help but feel that her friendship had contributed to some of the changes in Grace. Grace had changed Sister Agnes, too. A nun's life could be lonely. Most of the other Sisters of Mercy were old enough to be Sister Agnes's mother, if not her grandmother. Over the last few months, she had come to cherish the easy friendships she seemed to have developed with Grace Brookstein. The shared glances, the smiles, the trust. Grace put the puzzle pieces back into their box, then stacked it neatly on the shelf. Sister Agnes smiled warmly.
"Thank you, Grace. I can finish up here. I know you want to get to the library."
"That's all right," said Grace cheerfully. "I'm happy to help. Oh, by the way, that modeling clay that we ordered last week, we need to return it."
"Do we? Why?"
"I opened 7 or 8 of the crates this morning, and the stuff inside had completely dried out. I tried soaking it in water, but it ended up all slimy. It'll have to go back."
What a pain, thought Sister Agnes. It had taken her the better part of a day to stack those crates in the Children's Center storeroom with Sister Teresa. Now she'd have to lug the stupid things back out again.
"I emailed the delivery company," said Grace. "They're coming to pick them up on Tuesday at 4 o'clock.
"Tuesday?" Sister Agnes looked pained.
"Oh, Grace, it was kind of you to arrange it, but I can't supervise a pickup on Tuesday, I'm afraid. A delegation from the Department of Corrections will be here for a tour. Sister Teresa and I have our quarterly budget meeting with them afterward. We'll be out all afternoon."
"Oh."
Grace looked disappointed. Then suddenly she brightened.
"Perhaps I could do it."
Sister Agnes frowned. "I don't know about that, Grace." Inmates in the A-Wing were not supposed to help with pickups or deliveries. The warden considered it a potential security risk. But Grace had come so far in her rehabilitation. Sister Agnes would hate to give her the impression that she wasn't trusted.
Grace said, "The children have already waited weeks. It seems a shame to delay things even further."
"Those crates are heavy, Grace," Sister Agnes said awkwardly. "It's a 2-person job."
"Cora can help me."
"Cora Butts?" This idea was going from bad to worse.
"She has KP duty on Tuesdays, but she's usually finished by 3.
Grace looked so hopeful, so eager to please. Sister Agnes wavered.
"What harm can it do, just this once?"
"Well, I suppose, if you're sure you and Cora can handle it."
Grace smiled. "Loading a delivery truck? Yes, sister, I think we can manage that."
Her heart was pounding so loudly, she was surprised Sister Agnes couldn't hear it. She was a sweet, kind woman, and Grace felt bad deceiving her. But it couldn't be helped. It was starting. Grace Brookstein's planned escape attempt rapidly became the worst-kept secret at Bedford Hills. The idea was simple. The delivery truck would arrive at the children's center. Grace and Cora Buds would begin loading up the crates of clay. While Cora distracted the driver, Grace would go back into the storeroom, empty one of the crates, and hide herself inside it. Cora would complete the loading on her own, making sure that the lid of Grace's crate was not fully sealed to allow her some air and that it was hidden well back among the others. It was the next part of the plan that was the wild card. Everything rested on the security check. Trucks came in and out of Bedford Hills every day, delivering anything from toilet paper to detergent to food. The prison was equipped with state-of-the-art security systems. As well as manual searches, the guards used sniffer dogs and even infrared scanners to spot-check vehicles, in addition to the CCTV cameras that were everywhere at Bedford. Typically, the more thorough searches took place on the way into the prison. There was less emphasis on what might be going out. But all searches were at the guard's discretion. If they didn't like the look of a driver, or a vehicle, or if they just felt like it for whatever reason, they could hold people up for hours, X-raying every square inch of their car or person. Grace hoped that, on a cold January night, the guard's appetite for hauling out crate after crate of children's modeling clay would be low. But she wouldn't know until they got to the checkpoint. Once the truck was waved through, if it was waved through, and they drove clear of Bedford, Grace would climb out of the crate and make her way to the rear doors. As soon as the driver stopped at a junction, she would open the door of the truck and jump to freedom. Easy. It's not going to work. Karen leaned across the table and helped herself to Grace's watery mashed potatoes. They were at lunch, a few days before the breakout was supposed to take place.
Thanks for the vote of confidence.
Have you thought about what you're going to do if you do make it out of here? Grace had thought of little else. When she fantasized about her escape, she pictured herself as the hunter, unmasking Lenny's killer, wreaking her revenge. But the reality was that she would also be hunted down. If she were going to survive, she'd need food, shelter, money, and a disguise. She had no idea how she was going to obtain any of them.
What about friends on the outside? Is there anybody you can trust? Anyone who'll cover for you?
Grace shook her head.
No. No one.
There was one person she trusted. Davy Bucola. Davy was working on new information, checking out the alibis for everyone who'd stayed with Grace and Lenny on Nantucket the day Lenny died. If Grace turned to anyone on the outside, it would be him. But she wasn't about to tell Karen that.
In that case, we need to fix you up with a survival pack from here.
A survival pack?
Sure. You'll need a new identity, a few new identities so you can keep moving, driver's licenses, credit cards, some cash. You won't get very far as Grace Brookstein.
Where am I going to get a driver's license from, Karen? Or a credit card? It's impossible.
Said the woman who figures she's going to escape from Bedford Hills. Don't sweat the small stuff, Grace. Leave that to me.
Karen had warned Grace that she would need to let a few of the girls in on the escape plan in order to get what they needed in such a short space of time. To Grace's horror, a few of the girls turned out to be almost every inmate at Bedford. Forging a credit card and a driver's license was no mean feat. Karen was forced to corral help from all over the prison. Inmates in the warden's office, the library, and the computer room typed, photoshopped and laminated for days, all of them risking their own paroles and futures for a chance to help Grace and be part of the great escape. The only people who didn't know about the plan were the guards and Lisa Halliday. It was debatable whether Lisa would have snitched on Grace. Powerful inmates could attack their rivals with impunity, but selling out another prisoner was still considered taboo. Still, Karen wasn't prepared to risk it. Grace was too grateful for everyone's help, but she was nervous.
Too many people know.
They're not people, Karen told her. They're your friends. You can trust them. Trust. It was a word from another life. Another planet.
Tuesday morning dawned gray and cold. Grace had barely slept. All night long, the voices haunted her. Lenny. Whatever happens, Grace, I love you. John Merrivale.
Don't worry, Grace. Just do what Frank Hammond tells you and you'll be fine.
Karen.
When they catch you, they'll shoot you. No questions asked.
Grace didn't touch her oatmeal at breakfast.
You need your strength,
Cora Buds told her.
Eat something!
I can't. I'll throw up.
The big black woman narrowed her eyes.
I ain't asking you, Grace. I'm telling you. You better get it together, girl. I'm putting my hide on the line for you today. We all are. Now eat.
She's right. I can do this. I have to do it.
Grace ate.
Are you sure you're all right, Grace? Perhaps you should go and lie down.
It was noon at the Children's Center. The delegation of senior prison officials was due to arrive at 12:30. The morning had been spent tidying up desks and toys, putting up fresh artwork, and generally ensuring that the facility looked its very best. If the delegation was impressed, they might raise the budget, or at least not slash it. Grace had worked diligently as usual, but Sister Agnes was worried about her. Her complexion had been green when she arrived for work this morning. Now it had faded to a sickly off-white. A moment ago, reaching up to a high shelf to rearrange some books, she'd become dizzy and almost fainted.
I'm fine, sister.
I don't think you are fine. The infirmary ought to take a look at you.
No!
Grace felt her throat go dry with panic.
You can't send me to the infirmary. Not today. What if they keep me all afternoon?
She remembered what Cora said to her at breakfast. She had to pull herself together.
I'm a little dehydrated, that's all. Perhaps I could have a glass of water?
Sister Agnes went to fetch the water. While she was gone, Grace pinched her cheeks and took some deep, calming breaths. By the time the nun returned, she looked slightly better. Far from the corner of the room, Lisa Halliday watched the scene with suspicion.
"What's up with Lady Brookstein?"
she asked one of the mothers, a young black woman who hadn't been at Bedford long.
"She's been acting weird as shit all morning, even by her standards."
"Wouldn't you be if you was gonna bust out of here?"
said the girl. One look at Lisa's face told her she'd screwed up big time. But by then, it was too late.
What did you say?
Nothing. I was just... I don't know what I'm talking about. It's just some crazy rumors.
Lisa Halliday put her face within an inch of the girl's.
Tell me.
Please, I shouldn't have said nothing. Cora'll kill me.
Tell me everything.
or I'll make sure the warden never lets you see your kid again.
Please, Lisa.
You think I can't do it?
The girl thought about her son, Tyrone. He was 3 years old, as cute and chubby as a puppy. He'd be here in half an hour, snuggling up to her, drawing pictures for her to keep in her cell. She started to talk. Hannah Denzel knitted her beetle brows into one long, angry caterpillar as she led the VIPs down the hall to the children's center.
This way, ladies and gentlemen.
Denny did not like showing delegations around Bedford Hills. Today's self-important posse of politicians and police officers was as bad as all the others. The do-gooder prison visitors, the priests, the social workers, the therapists, the nuns, the whole goddamn army of meddlesome outsiders who infested her territory twice a year with their clipboards and recommendations. None of them seemed to realize that these women were vermin. That they were at Bedford Hills to be punished, not saved. It made Denny sick. The group oohed and ahed all over the children's center, scattering among pristine workstations and play areas. Warden McIntosh stood watching them like a proud father. Then his face changed. Grace Brookstein was hovering by one of the bookcases, looking pale and ill. Damn it. He'd completely forgotten about Grace. The last thing he needed was to have his most notorious prisoner distracting the group's attention from the jewel in Bedford's crown. He whispered in Hannah Denzel's ear, "Get her out of here. Quietly. She's a distraction." The prison guard's cruel eyes lit up.
"Yes, sir."
This was more like it. Walking over to Grace, she grabbed her roughly by the arm.
"Let's go, Brookstein. Back to your cell."
"My cell? But I can't,"
Grace stammered.
"I'm working."
"Not anymore, you're not. Move it."
Grace opened her mouth to protest, but no sound came out. Panic rose up in her throat like vomit.
"Is something the matter?"
Sister Agnes glided over.
"Can I help?"
"No,"
snapped Denny, pushing Grace toward the door. She resented the Sisters of Mercy's presence at Bedford Hills. Sister Agnes should back the fuck off to her rosary and leave the inmates to the professionals.
"Warden wants this one on lockdown, and he doesn't want a scene."
Grace looked pleadingly at Sister Agnes.
"Help me."
The nun smiled kindly at her friend.
"Don't look so woebegone, Grace. You could do with a little rest. Enjoy your afternoon off. We'll still be here tomorrow."
"Yes, and now so will I," thought Grace.
She could have wept. It was 3:45 before Lisa Halliday was able to get out of the children's center. That slave-driving do-gooder, Sister Teresa, had given her a list of chores as long as her police record. Sprinting to the warden's office, she marched up to the reception desk.
"I need to see the warden," she panted. "It's urgent."
The receptionist looked at the surly Bull Dyke in front of her and stiffened.
"Warden McIntosh can't see anybody today. He has a delegation."
"Like I said, it's urgent."
"I'm sorry," the girl repeated. "He's not here."
"Well, where is he?"
The receptionist's tone got frostier.
"Out. He's in meetings all afternoon. Is it something I can help you with?"
No,
said Lisa rudely.
I want the organ grinder, not the friggin' monkey.
She had to see the warden, and she had to see him alone. If word got out that she was the Fink who'd sold out Grace Brookstein, she'd be finished at Bedford Hills.
Then there's nothing I can do.
Lisa sank her great bulk down onto one of the hard chairs lining the wall. Fine. I'll wait. Cora Buds left her job in the kitchen at 3:50 and hurried over to the children's center as arranged. Two mothers were saying goodbye to their kids while a single, bored guard looked on. Cora asked one of the mothers,
"Where's Grace?"
"In lockdown. Denny dragged her off hours ago. She didn't look well."
Cora thought,
"I bet she didn't. That's it, then. If Grace is in lockdown, the whole plan goes up in smoke."
She walked into the storeroom alone.
"Maybe it's for the best."
Grace sat on her bunk, staring into space. She was too drained to cry. It was over. God knew when she'd have a chance to try again. Maybe not for years. Years in which whoever killed Lenny would be out there, free, happy, unpunished. The thought was unbearable. Mindlessly, she looked at the clock on the wall. 3:55. 4. 4:05. The truck would be there by now. Cora would be loading it, alone, wondering what had happened. At 4:08, Grace heard the jangle of keys in the lock. Karen's shift must have ended early. At least she'd be pleased the escape plan had failed. The door swung open.
"Get up!"
Denny's eyes blazed with spite. She'd been brooding all day over Sister Agnes's words to Grace. "Enjoy your afternoon off." As if this was some sort of summer camp. There were no afternoons off at Bedford Hills. "You missed 4 hours of work detail this afternoon, you sneaky little bitch. Thought you were on vacation, did you? A free pass?" Grace said meekly,
"No, ma'am."
"Good, because there are no fucking vacations in A-Wing. Not while I'm in charge. You can make up those work hours and starting right now. Get your ass over to the children's center and start scrubbing the floors."
"Yes, ma'am."
"When you've finished, do it again. And you can forget about eating tonight. You stay on that floor scrubbing until I come for you, understand?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Move!"
Grace bolted out of the cell and started running down the corridor. Denny watched her go, a slow smile of satisfaction spreading across her face. She had no idea that Grace was running for her life. Cora Buds had almost finished loading the crates. The truck driver grumbled,
"I thought there was gonna be two of yous. I'd have brought another guy if I'd have known."
Cora shrugged.
"Life's a bitch, ain't it?"
It was already dark in the cramped courtyard backing onto the children's center storeroom. The temperature was below zero, but the biting wind made it feel even colder. The boxes were small, about 2 feet square. Looking at them, Cora couldn't imagine how Grace had ever thought she was going to squeeze herself inside one. They were also heavy. Their weight, combined with the finger-numbing cold, made the work slow going.
"Sorry I'm late."
Grace stood, shivering in the lamplight. Still in her skirt and thin cotton, she was ridiculously underdressed for the winter evening.
The wind sliced into her skin like razor blades. Cora Budd's eyes widened in surprise, but she said nothing.